Is this the only cure, merciful God? Each pore and natural outlet shriveled up by ignorance and parching poverty. His energies roll back upon his heart and stagnate and corrupt till changed to poison. They break out on him like a loathsome plague spot. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Sunday Morning Poetry on the Troubadour Podcast. Today, we're going to cover The Dungeon by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Now, this is another poem in Lyrical Ballads, the 1798 version, that comes from the play that Coleridge wrote, Osario. Now, this play was not available to those who read the 1798 Lyrical Ballads. So we're going to take it in that context, just like we did last time. So if you want even more context, go to my episode last week for Sunday Morning Poetry, The Foster Mother's Tale. That is also taken from Osario, and it's in Lyrical Ballads. And that one's actually a dialogue. So what we're going to get here is actually what's called a soliloquy. Now, a soliloquy is basically when a character in a play expostulates, it talks about, it goes in front of the stage and expresses their inner thoughts. So it's a very unique thing to theater because, one, it's not how humans tend to express themselves in many ways. It's a little bit different than a monologue, because a monologue could just be a long speech by a character, even if there's another character present. A soliloquy is explicitly about the inner workings of an individual character on a stage. So we're going to get that. Now, if you listen to The Foster Mother's Tale, it'll give you context. But if you wait till a little bit later in this episode, I will give a little bit of context from Osario to add to the understanding of this. But I want to approach it in the way that they would have read it and experienced it in 1798, which is without the play Osario. Because again, it was written but not published for many years later. Now, one context that I think will help is that Osario was written, The Dungeon was written, in 1798. And when it was published, it was very much attacked as being too soft on criminals. And I think that's necessary and helpful to go into this with the understanding that this is about a dungeon, a medieval dungeon, which is, of course, where you would torture and prison, and even to some degree, we would think about reforming prisoners. And one of the questions that comes up is a philosophical question. And it's actually a question that comes out of Samuel Godwin's, who we've talked about many times on this, William Godwin, who was the father of Mary Shelley, and he was a political philosopher in his own right. And William Godwin wrote Political Justice. And one of the things he talked about was how you have this societal things that get in the way of man becoming a man, and man in his best state of nature being the best that he can be. And that all these things that we put on man and society actually get in the way of him, any kind of reform that may be possible, or really that it's the society that causes these convicts and horrible ideologies. And this kind of progressive idea is what we would call, this is one of the views I think that a lot of progressives have. Now, whether you agree with the philosophy or not is kind of beside the point, and we can kind of parse it out as we go. I think it's helpful to think about, though, even if you disagree with it, and this is a good expostulation of Godwin's political justice theory in his book Political Justice. So let's go through the poem. Let me read it. Remember, this is a So one way to picture this, let's step back. Before I give you the picture of what's going on, I want you just to experience it like they had it in 1798. So just experience the words, we'll talk about it, and then I'll help you draw a little bit of a picture to get a better understanding of it. Okay, so here we go with The Dungeon by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And this place our forefathers made for man? This is the process of our love and wisdom. to each poor brother who offends against us, most innocent, perhaps? And what if guilty? Is this the only cure? Merciful God, each poor and natural outlet shriveled up by ignorance and parching poverty, his energies roll back upon his heart and stagnate and corrupt till changed to poison. They break out on him like a loathsome plague spot. Then we call in our pampered mountebanks, and this is their best cure, uncomforted and friendless solitude, groaning and tears, and savage faces at the clanking hour, seen through the steam and vapors of his dungeon, by the lamp's dismal twilight. So he lies circled with evil, till his very soul unmolds its essence, hopelessly deformed by sights of ever more deformity. With other ministrations thou, O nature, healest thy wandering and distempered child. Thou pourest on him thy soft influences, thy sunny hues, fair forms, and breathing sweets, thy melodies of woods and winds and waters, till he relent, and can no more endure to be a jarring and dissonant thing amid this general dance and minstrelsy, but bursting into tears wins back his way, his angry spirit healed and harmonized by the benignant touch of love and beauty. Okay, so, you know, it's a lot of words thrown at you in an odd way that you're probably not used to, so it's okay if you don't have a full grasp and a firm grasp of what's going on, but you probably caught some of it, right? You probably caught little inklings of a feeling, an emotion, a taste, a knowledge of what he's talking about, right? So what do you think he's talking about when he says, is this the only cure? I mean, the poem's called The Dungeon. Well, I mean, it's not, I think you can figure it out, right? I think you don't need me for stuff like that. And I don't think, you know, I think you can do this all on your own, but my point is that I think it's there, you know, you can do it. It's not the most complicated verse like we did John Donne. And sometimes the way he structures his sentences, where you have a verb that's at the end of a line that actually applies to two clauses that came before the verb. I mean, it's all kind of wacky sometimes. This is much more straightforward in a lot of ways. And that was one of the goals of lyrical ballads, to make it possible for the everyman, for the not, you know, you don't have to go to Cambridge and spend all your life studying this stuff to understand it. You could be like me, a trucker kind of guy living in an RV that could figure this stuff out. Now, let's go into this stanza or line by line. There's only two stanzas, so it's not structured like, you know, a sonnet where you might have three very structured stanzas and they have particular meter and a particular rhyme scheme. This is in an open verse or a blank verse, which, remember, does have a meter, even if it doesn't rhyme. So blank verse is meter, but without rhyme. So meter, you know, basically you just think about like the syllables in each line. There's a certain way that it goes, and it's usually iambic pentameter. So this is what this structure is in, but there's not a rhyme. It doesn't have to rhyme at the end of every line or every other line or something like that. Now, free verse, again, doesn't have anything, right? And I'm not a fan of free verse because it's basically just talking and there's no difference between it and it's usually not memorable. Meter helps with memory as one way to think about meter. It sticks in the brain. It resonates with how the brain works a little bit differently than just normal whatever you want verse, which is just too subjective. But that's another subject for another time. So the dungeon. So we have some kind of structure, but it's not the complete structure of a sonnet. Or think about like a haiku where it has to have a certain number of syllables. Okay. So in this place, our forefathers made for man. Exclamation point. So the, emphasizing this idea. So we know we're in a dungeon. Now, this is the second time you've read it. Right. So I always recommend reading once all the way through and then going through it a little bit slower. Sometimes you might need to read it two or three times all the way through to get a sense of the poem, and then go through it line by line. So what is this place? It's obviously the dungeon. So we have this setup of, oh, this place our forefathers have made for man. So he's setting up the argument, right? So this is the place that our forefathers and their wisdom, right? This is the process of our love and wisdom. So, you know, all these thousands of years that we've been in existence, you know, if you're Christian, he thinks maybe 5,000 years we've been around. And after all that time, the process of our love and the process of our wisdom and everything we've learned is to create this for our fellow man. To each poor brother who offends against us, most innocent, perhaps, but what if guilty? Right. So he sets up this question that to each poor brother who, whoever offends against us in some way, they steal from us, they get in a fight, or maybe they punch a municipal worker or something like that, right? Or they steal. Murder is, of course, the worst of all these, but there's a lot of things that you can, infractions you can have. Most are innocent, right? Maybe they did something against the crown. You know, they were treasonous and dealing with the enemy or something. But most are innocent, he's saying, perhaps. But what if they are guilty? What if these criminals are guilty? Right. So we're having a penal code discussion here. That's what we're clearly talking about, because we're in a dungeon. We're hearing something about, well, this is the forefathers making this dungeon. And this dungeon is the process of love and wisdom to each poor brother who offends, right, who breaks the law against us. And most are innocent, perhaps. And what if they are guilty? So this is a critical thing in the penal code. What if they are guilty? You know, what is the purpose of prison at that point? Does it reform or is it just punishment? This is a question we still ask to this day. What is the purpose of the penal of imprisonment? So then he asks another question. Is this the only cure? So now he's going to draw an analogy to something. So is this the only cure, merciful God, each pore, P-O-R-E, like a pore in your skin, and natural outlet shriveled up by ignorance and parching poverty, his energies roll back upon his heart and stagnate and corrupt till changed to poison. So for a second, you know, think about each pore and natural outlet are shriveled. This is what will happen to him in a dungeon. Now think about for a second a plant. Imagine you started seeing black splotches on a plant and it had some kind of disease or problem with the plant. Now, the thing you would not do is like throw it in a dark dungeon in a freezer, because that would just make it shrivel. It would need sunlight. Doesn't make sense to throw it into the, you know, into a dungeon. And it's the same thing with a person. Wouldn't the person shrivel up? And I mean, think about a common cliche today to some degree. This cliche that, you throw these men, you know, like we have different prisons because you don't want to intermingle really hardened criminals with not so hardened criminals. Because if you do, you might turn, or you very likely will turn, a not hardened criminal into a hardened criminal, right? And this is one of the problems with our own penal system that we have. And you know, whether there's how to do it better, that's not really my place to say. I'm not very up on that. I'm not very knowledgeable. But I would just say some of these arguments do make sense. And it's important to think about, well, if we're going to throw somebody, I mean, think about the character Jean Valjean. You know, for instance, I think he stole a piece of bread and he broke a window pane. So he does have to pay some kind of penalty for that, or he should, even if he had a just reason for it. I think it makes sense that he would have to. But was it too harsh? Did they just throw him in the harshest, you know, penalty possible? And then, you know, for instance, he got like a couple of years. I can't remember how many years at first, but he got a couple of years in prison. And then he tried to escape, and then he got a couple more years for trying to escape, and then a couple, and basically it ended up being something like 19 years, and it all started with stealing a piece of bread and breaking a window pane. Now, and you know, this whole thing took up 20 years of his life. And of course, when he gets out, he is a criminal, right? He bashes a bishop in the head and he steals all of his silver. So he's still a criminal, even though he thinks he's going to be safe after he leaves, and he's not. The point is that, you know, this idea of you go in for an infraction, you come out a murderer, that's not something that doesn't happen. And it's something that needs to be considered when these situations are going into. Now, you know, when we're talking about, well, what are we going to do with these prisoners? So this guy did break the law. He needs to be punished. And maybe it's, you know, not his first time stealing, for instance. Maybe Jean Valjean's not the best example. Someone who's stolen multiple times, has been fined and did everything you can outside. So now he's just got to go to prison. So then what do we do with them at that point? How long does he stay in prison? Does that reform him? Are we going to kill him? Like, you know, if he's going to eventually go out in society, how do we reform him? And how does prison do that? And if it doesn't turn him into a worse criminal? And that's one of the arguments I think he's making here, is each pore and natural outlet shriveled up by ignorance and parching poverty. So, you know, the person who's already, that offends them, one of the reasons is that they aren't natural as it is. They've shriveled up. What shriveled them up? What made them unnatural? Ignorance and parching poverty. This is an argument that, you know, so when you hear this by progressives today, it's the same argument they've been making for hundreds of years. Now, whether it's a legitimate argument or not, I don't quite agree with it, but I know what they're saying, and I'm trying to just get you to understand the argument of the poem and the analogy so you can appreciate the language. Each pore and natural outlet shriveled up. That's what happened to this individual before he offended, and the reason it shriveled up is by ignorance and parching poverty. Like, you can't drink a parched mouth. Caused by poverty. So the you know, again, Jean Valjean is a good example in this case, because Jean Valjean stole it to help his niece, I believe it was. And this is from Les Miserables, if you're unfamiliar. His energies roll back upon his heart, right? So read his life source. His life source would roll back upon his heart, causing stagnation and even corruption rather than healthy growth. Then in this isolated place, plague spots would break out on his body, caused by a rotting soul. So, you know, when we're talking about curing, we're trying to cure a plague in this sense, like something of an unnatural part of this criminal's soul. So what, you know, cures do they offer? Well, so they call pampered mountebank. Basically, you just think of this as charlatan selling remedies, snake oil salesmen. And these snake oil salesmen, these men selling fake remedies or claiming to have remedies, which I think we have to this day, right? Like, let's put a therapist in there. Let's put this in there. And let's have everyone sit in a circle and do it. You know, I don't know if that actually works for most people. Maybe it, you know, they think it works because occasionally someone is reformed, but maybe that person would have reformed on their own. Like, I don't have enough information, but I don't know that throwing a psychiatrist and having people in a circle, you know, talk about their feelings is actually the best way to reform a man who beat somebody else with a pipe. Like, I don't know that that's the case. You know, what's really causing it? I don't know that therapy is good enough, or that you can find the right therapist, or maybe somebody can say, you know, so I think there's something to therapy, but it has to be the right therapist. And when you put them in a group setting, is that the right situation? And, you know, so my point is, these today we have mountebanks selling these reforms. You know, I've even seen, you know, like, put dogs in there. Now, I'm fine with that. You know, like, put stray dogs and let these criminals take care of them, and that will reform them. I don't know that that's going to reform them. Maybe it is sweet and they have something, you know, to take care of, and maybe that does help them on some level. But does that mean that when he goes out and he's in parching poverty again, he's not going to bash someone's brains out? I don't know that that's the case, right? I doubt there's any information or any, you know, actual evidence that that would, on a grand scale, do anything. It might, you know, look nice and make a great viral video, but I don't know it'll be anything. So, you know, today we do this. So my point is that today we do the same thing, right? We call in our pampered mountebanks, right? So people from a completely different world who have no concept of the world that these prisoners come from, and they go in with their snake oil sales, their you know, let's put a turtle in every room, and that turtle will somehow magically put their chakras into the prisoner, and the prisoner will no longer want to rape and beat people to death. Okay, great. It's not going to happen, right? Pampered mountebanks. Now, in Coleridge's poem, it's his pampered mountebanks are going to do something else, and this is their best cure. Here we go. Uncomforted and friendless solitude, groaning and tears, and savage faces at the clanking hour. Seen through the, so like clanking of the streams, I assume it's something like, you know, when all the men are getting fed or something like that. And you know, so all they're seeing, so here are the cures: to be uncomforted, right? So they don't get a dog back then. So the mountebanks were different than the mountebanks today. The mountebanks today are more the Coleridge type, perhaps, that give comfort, that give friendly expressions to their community, right? That don't have groaning and tears, but that have hugs and kisses, right? And that don't have savage faces, but that have happy faces and dog faces. So that's what they do today. So in Coleridge's time, the cures by mountebanks were uncomforted and friendless solitude, groaning and tears, and savage faces at the clanking hour, seen through the steam and vapors of his dungeon by the lamp's dismal twilight. So that's the image. So that's like, I want you to take a moment to try to read through and think about that as an image. Like, picture that as an image of what a prisoner in this dungeon experiences. Uncomforted and friendless solitude. So he's in his little cell, cramped, you know, like 5x5 or whatever, and he can't even barely lay down. And friendless solitude, groaning and tears. So all around him, he just hears, right? And just these horrible sounds of a dungeon. And he sees savage faces. You know, the guard comes in and here's your food, right? And at the clanking hour, I'm not 100% sure what that means. I assume it's something like, you know, for food time. Seen through the steam and vapors of his dungeon. So he sees nothing at all. Like, imagine the plant that, you know, that's diseased. We put that in a dark hole with no sunlight. Vapors of his dungeon by the lamp's dismal twilight. So in other words, the mountebanks are having a very unnatural cure. Now, of course, this is the Romantics. This is Coleridge. You know, this is the lyrical ballad. So he's going to offer what's in a few minutes or a few lines, a natural cure, being more natural, you know, being in nature. This is why we think of them, the Romantics, as nature poets. Okay, continuing on the poem. So he lies circled with evil, till his very soul unmolds its essence, hopelessly deformed by sights of ever more deformity. So this is the solution that he has in the dungeon poem. The prisoner lies down. He's circled with evil. Right? So this is how we're going to cure him, right? Whether he's, remember we said at the beginning when he set it up, most innocent, perhaps, and what if guilty? So if he's guilty and all these things happen and he's poisoned and he's plagued and he's unnatural, and we want to say, we don't want you to be unnatural. We don't want you to be poisoned. We want you to be able to go into society now. Okay, well, but you're not doing anything to help him with that. All you're doing is, you know, he's lying circled with evil till his very soul unmolds its essence, hopelessly deformed by sights of ever more deformity. So then, of course, he's only going to get worse. It's very clear. This is what man has made of man. You know, and this place our forefathers made for man. He made this for man and he made it of man. Now we're going to have a alternative view next. So the next stanza starts with other ministrations thou, O nature. So ministrations, just think of religious services. So we're already starting this world where nature is going to take the place of these mountebanks, but it's going to, and I think you can think of the mountebanks as the religious medieval times, and they're the ones who built these dungeons in medieval times, and they were Christians, right? So Coleridge is kind of attacking that idea. And now he's saying other ministrations with other religious services. And I don't mean services just in Sunday services sense, but I mean like soup kitchens, going out and helping people. These are the ministrations that the dungeon represented in the past. And now we're talking about what nature as a religious institution will do. So with other ministrations, you, thou, O nature, healest thy wandering and distempered child. So with other services of a religious nature, heal this distempered, disorganized, unordered, chaotic soul, right? The criminal, because he's a child, distempered child. Thou is your, or you pour on him your soft influences, right? So pour, P-O-U-R. So we're getting that word pour several times, and I don't know if there's much of a matching of them, but, you know, we're thinking about poor people at some point. We're thinking about pores, you know, to each poor brother, each poor, P-O-R-E. So it's an interesting thing that, you know, because this is made to be spoken aloud, but it also is very helpful to read it in this case, especially when you have different pronunciations of something that sounds the same. So each poor brother, you know, each poor of your, thou poorest, right? So not poorest as though you have the least money of everybody in the whole neighborhood, but instead pouring, like I'm pouring a cup of coffee, or I'd like a cup of coffee, I'm a little tired. Thou pourest on him thy soft influences. So pour, O Mother Nature, you know, pour your soft influences onto this distempered, unorganized, chaotic child. And what kind of influences? Your sunny hues, H-U-E-S. So give him sunny days, right? So don't put him in a dungeon. What's the opposite of that? But let him out just like a plant out in the sunlight. Fair forms and breathing sweets. So let him breathe in nature. Let him breathe in the beauty of the nature around him and the forms of all these beautiful things around him. And thy melodies, the chirping birds and the butterflies and the rustling wind, right, of woods and winds and waters, till he relent and can no more endure to be a jarring and a dissonant thing amid this general dance and minstrelsy, but bursting into tears. So these are the things in counterpoise to what we read earlier of all these things that the dungeon gives us and the mountebanks, the cures that they give to us. This is a completely different view of that, or a completely different method of curing the criminal. Now, once he's had these things, he's going to start realizing he is a dissonant thing. That's Coleridge's view, to be a jarring and a dissonant thing. Amid this general dance and minstrelsy, but bursting into tears, wins back his way, his angry spirit healed and harmonized by the benignant touch of love and beauty. Now, I'm going to have to say personally, I don't agree that that would actually cure a criminal, most criminals. I have no doubt that perhaps there are some criminals that would be cured that way. But for me, it would be because they did it themselves, right? That it came from them. But that's something we could talk about another time. What he is saying is that if you put, and there is a kind of logic to this, I think that to be sympathetic to what Coleridge is saying, if you put a man who, you know, has a poison of the soul, which is related to a poison of the body, in this poem, right? He's giving you concrete, conscious, physical relationships between these things. You know, a loathsome plague spot, but it's not a plague spot like the actual plague that killed, you know, tens of thousands of Europeans, but it's a plague spot of the soul. And that's the only thing that could cause somebody to do bad things. To cure that, you don't put that person in a dank, dark, horrible dungeon with savage faces and gross sounds and all these nasty things, the dripping of a tortured, you know, device in the other room, and a man screaming down the hall, someone getting their head or getting dragged down the hall to get their head chopped off. Like, that kind of world is not the best for curing this soul disease, this plague of the soul. What will cure it are sunny hues, fair forms, you know, butterflies dancing around, being out in nature and enjoying the beauty of the world. Now, the argument makes sense, though, because we are physical creatures. So this is a mind-body integration. This is a look at both body and mind as one, rather than they're two separate things. And so the idea is that if we put man in nature as he's meant to be, just like a plant, you know, that there is a nature of man, that if you put him in these things, he will be better off. Now, again, I disagree, because of the nature of free will is a little bit more complex than that. But the point he's making, I think, does make sense in a lot of ways, right? Like, if something is diseased, you don't give more of that, right? And if you are going to just give more of it and just put them in a dank dark, you know, just like if you were with a plant, why not just kill everybody who steals anything instead of putting them in the dungeon? Because you're just making it worse, right? It's like, if someone had a plague and you're just going to dump more plague on their face, you're going to, what's the point, right? So, although I guess one argument they could make that maybe occurred to me is that if you put all the plague people in, that are infected with plague, physically, let's say, put them all in one place, 95% will die. The 5% that live, those are the good ones. So that's another way to think about it, is you throw all these men in the dungeon, and the ones that survive, those are the ones that perhaps had the chance of reforming in the first place. And yeah, so maybe that's how they thought of it, is, you know, instead of killing them, we'll just put them all together. And if they, you know, the ones that survive and through the process, they're the ones who have the possibility, they're strong enough to reform. That's possible. What Coleridge is saying is, no, that all you're doing is just making it worse. The better thing is to put them out in nature and let them enjoy nature. Okay. Now, if you read or you go back to last week's and you listen to the foster mother's tale and Osario, you'll realize that this is Albert. So if you remember from last time, there was the foster mother, there was Maria, and this is again in 1798 Lyrical Ballads poem. So it's a poem with actual characters, and I talked about this last time. So you have a foster mother telling a tale to Maria. At the end of that tale, at the end of what she's doing, and it's a moral tale trying to get Maria to take an action, and Maria is the stepbrother of Albert. This soliloquy is by Albert. So Albert is toward the end, and Albert is in a dungeon. He's imprisoned because he would not lie about a murder plot that Osario was going to do. He wouldn't reveal the murder plot, you know, of Osario. But the important part is that he was in the prison for lying about something very important, a murder plot. And Maria is revealed, there is a revelation to Maria. It is new information is going into her brain by her foster mother, who tells her a moral tale. Within it is embedded a way of breaking out Albert. And we also get a absconding of moral taboos in this moral tale, that sometimes it's okay to not think about Christian or societal morals. And in this case, sex between brother and sister. And of course it's a foster brother and sister, but still that's something that would be considered incest of a certain type, and it wouldn't be acceptable. The foster mother is essentially saying it is acceptable if you abscond from, if you leave from, if you forget society to some degree and forget the taboos. And here's a story of a man who did just that. And the idea is to inspire Maria to go take the action of finding this hidden tunnel, which is, you know, again, embedded in the story, is a magical key to get her foster brother out, which is this tunnel that was built. And she's supposed to get Albert and get him out. Now, this then is a little bit after that interaction between the foster mother and Maria. And it's a soliloquy. It is Albert's expression of the, you know, the dungeon. Now, it's not a personal one. He's not talking about, oh, you know, my poor and my natural outlets have shivered. my, you know, because it's shivered because of ignorance, and my plague has popped out on my soul or anything like that. And I'm friendless. And he's talking about a much more general view of reform and imprisonment and such, that it's in general, he's had this idea that this is not a good way to reform criminals, any criminal, whether they're innocent, right? Like he said earlier, most innocent perhaps, but what if guilty? What if they are guilty? Right? That's beside the point. Okay, so that's the dungeon. I think there's a lot you can look at and explore with this. There's, you know, each line has really good, you know, there's some great figurative language in here that is nice to listen to and to explore. But I hope that helped to open up the poem a little bit. There will be another poem down the line that I'm going to read called The Convict by Wordsworth, which is similar in its idea of reform, because again, they were both influenced by William Godwin, and they were both equally attacked by the people back then, just like we attack people, you know, who are too progressive today. Now, whether you're, whatever your views on it, you know, I've indicated that I do not agree that this is necessarily the best way to have a penal code. I don't think that it's helpful to society or the individual necessarily. But I do get the point that they're making. I mean, it makes sense. I think somebody can be, you know, we have to be sympathetic and think somebody can be in a bad birth, you know, birthed in a really horrible place and have really horrible circumstances. And so they make really bad decisions. And then those decisions compound. And then we make it worse by they, you know, when they're young, we throw them in prison and then they meet up with all these prisoners and they learn how to be a criminal. That's where a lot of criminals learn to be criminals. And it's like, you know, it's like a university for criminalization is one way I've heard prisons. And so we have to think, well, this, what we're doing isn't the best either. So, you know, how do we combine them? How do we make something where we can sift through the men who could be reformed? And, you know, this is who versus those who can't, and put those in a special institution. So there's just a lot to think about, but the poem I think is a good soliloquy of the expression of Albert's feelings about being in prison as a general idea. Okay. Well, I hope you enjoyed Sunday Morning Poetry on the Troubadour Podcast. Remember to go to troubadourmag.com because we put short stories as well as poems. We're publishing and looking for people to write us poems and short stories. Please go to troubadourmag.com and read The Clarion Call all the way down. If you click it at the top, it'll take you all the way down to the bottom of the page, and it'll give you some information and what we're looking for. So please, you know, we just published one recently by Maddox Herring, and we're going to continue to publish more, but we're looking for good authors and, you know, writers who have a romantic flair. You don't have to be a full-fledged 19th century romantic, but we want to have a little bit of that spark put back into society. Okay, I hope you enjoyed that, and I will see you next time.